A good Erev Shabbos to everybody. This Erev Shabbos, we're going to have the zchus to study Rav Salvechik's Torah, both on Chukas and on Balak, as I believe that Chutz Laretz catches up to Eretz Yisrael this Shabbos. So even Jerry could get something out of this for his Torah reading as well. We love the beautiful Yerushalayim air, the Yerushalayim sky that adds every week to the parasha. I apologize about last Friday. There was some personal issues and complications, family situations that came up. I apologize about it. It was beyond my control. I was planning on having a shiur. Baruch Hashem, everybody is fine. But then we had a difficult last Friday. So Baruch Hashem, everything's fine. Now I want to begin. Zos Chukas HaTorah, the Parah Aduma is famously a chok. It doesn't make sense to the rational, logical mind, mostly because that the kohen who pours the water becomes tamei, and the person who's tamei becomes tahar. When I was giving this over yesterday, I joked that when I was a kid in one of the famous youth organizations, they used to joke about that organization the same thing, that it was Matayr the Tameim and Matame the Tahorim. But this is a problem. This is a problem. So it seems to not make sense. Now Rav Salvechik has a beautiful idea about this. Zos Chukas HaTorah. This seems to be that all of Torah is considered to be a chok. Zos Chukas HaTorah. The whole Torah is one big chok. What do you mean the whole Torah is a chok? Much of Torah makes sense. So Rav Salvechik adopts the classic Brisker approach in this sense, that we know the Rambam, interestingly, the Briskers usually follow the Rambam, but in this they don't. The Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim writes, every mitzvah has a reason. Every mitzvah has a reason. Even those mitzvahs that appear to us to be chukim, it's just that we don't know the reason, we don't understand it, and we happen to understand 90% of them, 10% of them we don't understand. But everything, of course, has a reason. Hashem wouldn't make us do something that didn't have a reason. And Rashi and Achremos and Kedoshim, and the Briskers follow really Rashi. Rashi says, no mitzvahs have any reason. None of them have any reason. We do the mitzvahs because we're servants of Hashem. We're not supposed to. Who could understand why Hashem told us to do this? The Briskers say, why do you do it? Because Hashem said, that's it. It's a mitzvah. The Torah preceded the world by 955 years, the Medrash says. Hashem looked in the Torah and created the world. As a matter of fact, the Beis Halevi writes that that's the answer to the Ben Rasha. The Ben Rasha says, why are we still observing Pesach today? Pesach made sense thousands of years ago. Why is it relevant now to eat matzah? Okay, when they ate out of Egypt, then reclining made sense. Then eating matzah made sense. Back then, it made sense. What do I have to do with Yetzias Mitzrayim today? And what do we answer him? Bavur zeh asah Hashem li b'tzeis Mitzrayim. Because of the mitzvah of matzah, that's why Hashem took us out of Egypt. What do you mean, because of matzah? No, it should be the other way around. Because we left Egypt, that's why we eat matzah. Say the Briskers, no, you got it backwards. The mitzvah of eating matzah was around way before. Avram Avinu ate matzah way before there was a Yetzias Mitzrayim. We don't eat matzah because of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Hashem made a Yetzias Mitzrayim because there was a mitzvah of the Torah called matzah. Wow, it sounds very bizarre. Hashem made a world where not killing makes sense as a chesed does. The reason we don't kill is not because it makes sense not to kill. The reason we don't kill is because it says in Hashem's Torah not to kill. So that's the Brisker approach. So if Salvechik draws a very, very fascinating distinction between explaining mitzvos and interpreting mitzvos. He draws a distinction between explaining mitzvos and interpreting mitzvos. Sounds like semantics. It is semantics. What's the difference between explaining mitzvos and interpreting mitzvos? Listen to the words of Salvechik here. The chukim were classified by our rabbis as unintelligible, enigmatic, mysterious. It is forbidden to ask for the reasoning pertaining to certain divine imperatives. We may inquire into the interpretation. There is a difference between explanation and interpretation. Take physics, for example. Physics does not ask why, because why is not a scientific question. It's a metaphysical question. There could be no scientific why water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit or why light travels at 186,000 miles per second. Asking why Hashem issued certain commandments is seeking to comprehend the unfathomable. Man must recognize that the ultimate reason for mitzvahs is beyond his grasp. The very question of why in regard to mitzvah observance is philosophically invalid. And by the way, it sounds like he's not just saying this by the chukim. By the mishpatim also, it's that way. We don't know why. Yeah, listen to what he says. When we ask why in the concept of human activity, we are truly asking, when we ask why, we're asking what motivated Hashem. Motivation carries an implication of an unrealized need. But with regard to Hashem, it is impossible to ascribe any motivation to Hashem because Hashem neither has needs nor deficiencies. Thus, in response to the... By the way, this is against other people. But in the response to the question of why Hashem created the world, if you would ask your question of why Hashem created the world, we cannot give the answer that is because Hashem is kind and wanted to bestow kindness to the world. Some say that pshat. Rav Salvager said he thinks that that's apikarsis to say that. That Hashem has this need to give. Hashem doesn't have any needs. Having a need would imply that he's lacking something, that he needs to do something. This assertion implies that Hashem has some vague need to do good. The only acceptable answer, said Rav Salvation, to the question of why Hashem created the world is, he willed it. That's the answer. Why did he create the world? Because he wanted to. He willed it. As Rashi says on our Pasuk of Paraduma, Gezerahi Milfanai. So why did Hashem give us mitzvahs? They're all Gezerahi Milfanai. Why did Hashem create the world? Gezerahi Milfanai. We don't know God. We can't hope to understand why God does what he does. We don't know the chukim. And we'll see, what's the ultimate example of chok in the world? Death. Death. Zos chukas HaTorah. Death is the ultimate example of that which makes no sense. Because the world and Torah and Yiddishkeit is a world of life. Kiheim chayinu. Hashem is called the living God. Elokim chayin. But we have to accept it anyway. Even though death is tragic and it makes no sense and it scares us and offends our sensibilities, you have to accept it. However, the question of why cannot be asked of anything of Hashem. Why did Hashem create the world? Why did Hashem give us Shabbos? What? You can't ask that question. He's going to say in a second, it's a ridiculous question. However, the question what can be asked? What is the meaning of this chok as far as I am concerned? What does this chok tell me? How does this chok help me live my life? One does not ask, why did Hashem legislate Parah Adumah? Or how does Parah Adumah purify that he was impure? But you can ask, what is the spiritual message of Parah Adumah to me? Or how can I, as a thinking, feeling person, assimilate Parah Adumah into my world outlook? What does it mean to me? What can I get out of it? How can I grow from it? What lessons can I learn from it? That might not be why Hashem created. We have no idea why Hashem does what he does. He's way beyond our comprehension. Says Rav Soloveitchik, the Avoda Shebelev must be present in every religious act. Every act of service of Hashem, Hashem Libabai, we could have our heart involved in every act, in the ritual as well as the moral. Although the Kiyam HaMitzvah can be achieved through a mechanical, although the Kiyam HaMitzvah can be achieved through a mechanical approach, Avodas Hashem means not only to discharge the duty, and here he goes away from the briskers, not only to check off the box, but to enjoy, rejoice in and love the mitzvah. You hear this? Rav Salvechik says, now he goes like the Hasidim. That, yeah, the mechanical action, that's what the mitzvah is. But we're supposed to put our emotions into it. We're supposed to enjoy the mitzvah. We're supposed to love the mitzvah. But the Avodas Elokim is unattainable if the Chok does not deliver any message to us. So then what are you doing? You're just a robot. You're just a robot. In order to offer Hashem my heart and my soul, in order to serve Him inwardly with joy and love, the understanding and involvement and the logic of the Maisa Mitzvah is indispensable. We cannot experience the great bliss, the great experience of fulfilling Hashem's commandments if your emotions are neutral, shut out of that involvement. We have no right to explain chukim, but we have a duty to interpret them. You can't explain chukim, but we have a duty to interpret them. What does this mitzvah mean to me? How am I to understand its essence as an integral part of my avodas Hashem? We do not know why the mitzvah was formulated, but the question of how I can integrate and assimilate the mitzvah into my total religious consciousness, world outlook, and eye awareness, that question is not only permissible, but that's a chiyuv as an Eved Hashem for you to figure out what lessons, how could that change your life? How could that make you a more spiritual person? How could that connect you to Hashem more? How could the mitzvah connect you? So fascinating distinction Rav Soloveitchik says between the reason why Hashem made the mitzvah, that's 955 years before the world was created. That's way beyond our comprehension. We have no idea why, because He willed it. That's why. Why do we do it? We do it because He said so. But what can we get out of it? How can we grow from it? How can we become a more spiritual person? That we should explain. As a matter of fact, Rav Soloveitchik continues and says that Rashi actually has two explanations here. In the beginning, he just says Gzeri Milfanai, but then he quotes from Rabbi Moshe Adarshan, who explains, who has a remez for every little piece of it. If you look later on in the Rashi's, right, Rashi quotes from his Rebbe, Rabbi Moshe Adarshan, Aduma. Right later on, he goes at it again. If you look later on, all the way at the end, in Pasuk Chaf Beis, at the end of the Perek, he gives a whole message. At first he says it's all a chok, but then he explains every little nuance of it. So says Rav Soloveitchik, that's not explaining why Hashem created, but what we get out of it. And what's the ultimate chok? What's the ultimate chok? Death. That's why Hashem decided to say Zos chukas haTorah dafka by death. Let's continue. Hanogea b'meis l'chol nefesh adam v'tamei shivas yamim. Seder of Soloveitchik, the chok here is not merely in the performance of the Parah Aduma, but in the mind-defying mystery of death itself, whose defiling effects the watery ashes seek to counter. Death, the Torah tells us, has a contaminating effect. Rav Soloveitchik has stressed this many, many times, right? Death always causes tumah. Death is a mocking fate which awaits us all, a trauma of human helplessness which disturbs our serenity. It is an absurdity which undoes all of man's rational planning, his dreams and hopes. We wonder, why should the foremost of God's creations have an awareness of his mortality and live in constant dread and distress in face of its inevitability? The concept that death defiles is unique to Judaism. Judaism is about life. Hashem is called Elokim Chayim, Pasuk in Devarim. The Torah is called as Eitz Chayim. Egyptian civilization, like they mummied with the mummies, so they glorify death. And therefore, let's continue. Hanogea b'meis l'chol nefesh adam v'tamei. All tuma has one common denominator of Soloveitchik, being exposed to experiences which are depressing, ugly, and life-negating. Bugs, dead carcasses, all of which are emotionally and aesthetically jarring. Zav and zavar, shech vazera, disgusting bodily secretions. Diseases like tsaras, decaying dead organisms, sherets and nevela, and tumas meis. Tumas meis is recorded in this parsha different than all the other ones. All the other tumas are in Shemini, Tazria, Mitzora. All the other tumas. Only tumas meis is over here in Chukas. The Parah Aduma chapter should have been inserted in Tzav and Shemini. Tumas meis shares with other tumas the characteristic of dealing with a dead organism. But Tumas Mace involves something more horrible. That is, human death. Death is an unpleasant experience when encountered in the animal kingdom, but there it involves no more than cessation of functioning of an organism. With Tumas Mace, however, A spiritual personality has been terminated. A self-conscious individual who was possessed of visions, hopes, joys, despair, and grief. A being who anticipated the future, remembered the past, and shaped the present. We are dealing with a human personality who has the capacity to build and destroy worlds. Human death is a most tragic event. Man endowed with time awareness knows that his existence is transient. Even as he relates to Hashem, he knows that death will terminate his earthly worship. The Chachamim tell us what most disturbed them about death was that it interrupted their service of Hashem. The Gemara in Ksuba says, when Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was very sick, Rabbi Chia came to visit him and he found Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was crying. Rabbi Chia said to him, "Why are you crying? We know that if you die cheerfully, it's a good sign, but when you die, you're crying, it's a bad sign. Because if you're happy when you do, you know you're going to Olam Haba. If you're crying, what, you're a Baal Aveira?" Rabbi Yehuda said to him, "I'm crying because of the Torah and mitzvahs that I will no longer be able to perform." Whatever beneficent rewards awaited him in Olam HaEmes, they did not compare to the privilege of Torah study and the performance of good deeds here on earth. Death is an enemy. It destroys holiness. The Navi says, "Lo ha-mesim yahalalu ka, velo kol yardei duma." Death in the animal world is not tragic. Man, in contrast, is not merely representative of his group, but has inherent value. He has autonomous value. Each person is an olam katan, an individual with dignity and original with worthiness. Kishem shadeu seim shonim kach parts of fame. Just like every man is different, that's why every man looks different. Man's singular humanity establishes his status, not the class or society. Right, an animal, all the lions are the same, all the tigers are the same, all of the frogs are the same. There's no one has a unique personality. But by man, it's not like that. Every person can say, not with arrogance, but in a spirit of personal challenge, "Bishvili nivra ha'olam." Only a human being can say that. The whole world was created for me. Man was created as an individual. He teaches that anyone who destroys one individual, it's as if he destroyed a whole world. And if you matzil, if you save one person, it's like you saved the whole world. That is why human death is so abhorrently ugly. Tumas Meis is an enemy ever lurking in the shadows, which disturbs our serenity, precisely because we are conscious of its inexorable finality. But again, instead of being a message of doom and gloom, we can turn this message around and make it a message of big chizuk. Every moment on this earth that a person has a life is to be celebrated and rejoiced in and used to the utmost. One of my favorite psukim in Tanakh, which we recite every morning. No, only on Shabbos morning. Lemnos yameinu kein hodav v'navi levav chachma. To count each of our days, that's a person who's truly wise. To make every day count. If we're learning about the Tumas Meis, we're learning about how, for a human being, this is the ultimate chok, because life for us as Jews is the ultimate existence, that we appreciate life, we love life, we live life to the fullest. We take every moment of life as a precious ability to grow and to develop and to enjoy our connection with Hashem. As he says in the next line. The chapter which introduces the Paraduma opens the word Zos Chukas HaTorah. What is this enigmatic chok? It is identified by the word Zos HaTorah Adam Kiyamos. The ultimate mystery of human existence, the ultimate chok, is death itself. So said Rav Soloveitchik. Okay, enough about death. Enough about death. There's so much, as usual, yes, so much to talk about. Since Jerry's on the call, we got to say something from Balak also, because in Eretz Yisrael they're learning Balak. In Chutz La'aretz we're doing Chukas and Balak. So I'm going to go all the way to the end to make sure I get this piece, because very, very powerful piece. Rav Soloveitchik talks about the dangers of excess. Something about Achdus There's a lot of long piece over here about Achdus and about Yiddishkeit. Okay. We'll start with this piece. See how far we get. There's two pieces in Balak. Two beautiful pieces. So Hein Am Levadad Yishkon Uvagoyim Lo Yischashav. Bilam Harasha prophesied about the Jewish people. You can take a look. It's on page 187 in this edition. It's Perek Chaf Gimel. Pasuk. Tes. Hein Am Levadad Yishkon. The Jewish people are a nation that dwells alone. Hein Am Levadad Yishkon Uvagoyim Lo Yischashav. We are not considered as part of the nation, as part of the nations of the world. We are separate, we are different. So if Soloveitchik wants to speak about this a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit, a lot of it. Unity in Klal Yisrael is a basic principle in Judaism. Our people have formulated the principle of the unity of the Jewish people with one sentence. Ata echad, v'shimcha echad, umi ka'amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz. You Hashem are one and your name is one. Umi ka'amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz. The Jewish people are a singular nation. We are goy echad. We are one unified nation, but we are also a singular nation. We are different, we are unique. This principle of unity expresses itself in two ways. First, the unity of the Jews as members of a spiritual community, as a congregation which was established through a bris at Har Sinai. Va'atem tiyu li mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. The unity of the Jewish people as a community is based on the uniqueness of the Jewish way of life, a Torah existence. What ties the Taimani water carrier in the streets of Tel Aviv to the Jews of Boston? The same Shulchan Aruch, the same Shema Yisrael, the same Shabbos, the same Kol Nidre, the same Seder night, the same Kashrus, well, almost the same Kashrus, the same Tefillin, the same Chesed, the same yearning for Mashiach. We are all one people. The Hebrew word Eda is the same as Aid, witness, Edus. A spiritual religious entity is tied through an consciousness to a vast memory of a people about a divine law. A collective testimony unites us all into a Jewish community. The Jew who erases from his memory this great testimony, destroying the unique tradition, breaks the tie which joins him with the Jewish community. As part of a spiritual Torah entity. That's one aspect of unity. We're all observing the same commandments. However, unity also manifests itself in our unique political, historical lot as a nation. We are unique not only in our way of life, but in our historical transmigrations and in our paradoxical fate. Our history would not fit into a different historical framework. And our fate is incomprehensible. The enigma of our existence is primarily revealed through our loneliness and our affliction in all times, the current era included. 1960s, 1970s. That's when he's talking. Hein am levadad yishkon uvagoyim lo yischashav. We are alone among the nations of the world. The state of Israel did not avoid this unique fate. Quite the contrary. It has given expression to it in a more concrete fashion. No Jew can renounce his part of the unity which emerges from the fate of the loneliness of the Jewish people as a nation. This unity is based upon the conclusion of the bris in Egypt, which occurred even prior to Matan Torah. V'yakach eschem li la'am, v'yisi lachem le'elokim. This bris forced upon us one uniform historical fate. The Hebrew word am is identical with the word im. Our fate of unity manifests itself through historical and dispensable union. When we are faced with a problem, I'm sorry, he goes on a little bit here, but it's very beautiful. When we are faced with a problem for Jews and Jewish interests regarding the defense of Jewish rights in the non-Jewish world, then all groups and movements must be united. He says like this, when we're talking about politics or history or the state of Israel or our fate as a people, then we should join together with Reform and Conservative. In this area, there may not be any division, because any friction in the Jewish camp may be disastrous for the entire people. In this realm, we must consider the ideal of unity as a political historical nation, which includes everyone from France to the old-fashioned Jews of Mea Shearim, without exception. In the crematoria of Auschwitz, the ashes of the Hasidim and pious Jews were put together with the ashes of the radicals and the atheist Jews. And we all must fight the enemy, who does not differentiate between the one who believes in God and the one who rejects God. However, with regard to our problems within the Jewish community, our spiritual religious interests such as Jewish education, synagogues, councils of rabbis, he's talking about the New York Board of Rabbis, whereby unity is expressed through spiritual ideological collectivism as a Torah community, Center of Salvechik, in that area, it is my opinion that Orthodoxy cannot and should not unite with such groups which deny the fundamentals of our worldview. So when it comes to political issues that affect all the Jewish people, that we should bind together with the Reform and Conservative. The status of the Jewish state, things like that, persecution of Jews, things like that, we have to bind together with Conservative and Reform. But when it comes to education, there we have to stay separate from them. Continues of Soloveitchik about the Jewish people being different. From its very inception, Judaism is strikingly different from other faiths. It has embodied ideas, a way of life, and aspirations for the future which set the Jewish people apart from other groups. A rather unfriendly observer like Bilam nevertheless felt compelled to characterize the Jews as a nation that will dwell alone and will not be among the other nations. Center of Soloveitchik. There are three primary areas of distinctiveness without which Judaism would lose its essential character. Number one, mitzvos, the commandments. Behavioral imperatives, which are derived from the Torah. They find their precise formulation in the halacha and have been codified by Jewish scholars over the centuries. These commandments are very personal to the observant Jew, reflecting the inner mystery of Israel's commitment to Hashem. They have suggestive meanings and emotional overtones which are known only to two partners of the covenant. To equate these mitzvahs with the ritual observances of another faith is to belie the distinctiveness of both. To declare these mitzvahs as no longer obligatory is to divest Judaism of its primary mark of singularity. Such acts of reductionism are essentially fraudulent. So number one is commandments. Number two is doctrines. Judaism regards its dogmas and values as verities which are rooted in the Torah tradition and whose authority is divine, like we believe in Mashiach. It's not a mitzvah. We believe that the Torah can't be changed. The beliefs. Our theological and philosophical premises about God, man, and creation are uniquely Jewish, like that God can't have a form, right? Can't have a body. That's a Jewish concept. And through the course of centuries have been preserved despite efforts at dissuasion, ridicule, and torture. We in modern times have not been authorized by our millennia-old history to revise these historical attitudes or to trade the fundamentals of our faith for the illusory pursuit of interfaith goodwill. This would be a betrayal of our great tradition and would produce no practical benefits. A cringing readiness to barter away our identity will never evoke the respect of any who confront us. You see who he's talking to, right? Only a staunch and unequivocal bearing reflecting our firm commitment to God and a sense of pride and privilege in what we are will impress other faith communities. So number one is mitzvos. Number two is ideology, hashkafas. Number three is belief in the future, in Mashiach. Future expectations. Judaism foresees and eagerly awaits the coming of Mashiach, the vindication of Jewish singularity and chosenness, the ingathering of the dispersed in the Holy Land, the reestablishment of the Beis Hamikdash, the universal acknowledgement of ethical monotheism, and the realizations of world peace. These beliefs have sustained us for countless centuries in periods of trial. They are called eschatological expectations, since they represent our vision of the future, which we anticipate with exultant certainty. Other faiths define their eschatological expectations in other terms. adopting the religious practices of others, the dilution of our philosophies, and the wavering of Mashiach would spell the end of the vibrant and great faith experience of our 4,000-year-old history. Mamish, you listen to Rav Soloveitchik talk about Yiddishkeit. He raises the whole Yiddishkeit for us and tells us how lucky we are, how special we are to be part of this very, very special nation. And I'm going to close with something at the very, very end of, before I get that one little stop off along the way, we get to the very, very end of the parasha. I don't know what this has to do with the pasuk, but Bilam says, "Asher machazei shadai yechazeh." Bilam was zeicha. Where is this pasuk? It's on page 193 in this edition. So the third time Bilam prophesied, he says, Perek Chaf Dalad. Perek Dalad. Chaf Dalad. Nu'um Shomer Imri Kael. Bilam was zeicha to be a prophet. Asher machazei shaka yechzeh. He gets to see the visions of Hashem. Bilam had this closeness. Listen to what Rav Soloveitchik said. Can you imagine a guy gets to see God, but he could still be such an oisvarf? How could it be somebody who had such a powerful vision of Nevuah, but was such a... was such an oisvarf, was such a Russia, was such a despicable human being? How could it be if he had this access to Hashem? Listen to what Rav Soloveitchik has to say about this. Very fascinating. In two sentences. What is more important? A disciplined life ruled by ethical laws or a foggy mystical experience devoid of any impact or of the religious norm? It is clear that the former is far better, even if the experience of God in such a life is more remote. The German religious and philosophical tradition from Meister Eckhart to Heidegger was noted for its sentimentalism and metaphysical disposition, its understanding of infinity. Yet it had no appreciation for the religious norm. It never understood that religion is identical with the religious imperative. Bilam was close to God and was still a satanic figure. Cruelty and mysticism went hand in hand in Catholicism. Whoa. The religious norm provides a fulcrum for one's life. Such a fulcrum is to be greatly preferred to living one's life in a subjective religious fog. He says you could be like holy and super spiritual and still be an idiot. That's what he says. The fact that we have a Torah and mitzvot that regulate our lives, that's what keeps us honest. That's what keeps us on the straight and narrow. Religion is not about heady, wild trips and feelings and mystical things. It's about every single day davening and putting on tefillin and putting on tzitzis and keeping Shabbos and keeping the mitzvahs and going to shul and all the things that we do. That's what being a Jew is about. Even if you're asher machzai shaka yechaz, that doesn't mean you're going to be a good person. And lastly, we'll close with this. I have to end a few minutes early today. And lastly, we'll close with this. What happens at the very end of Balak? The people commit sins with the daughters of Moab. The people commit sins with the daughters of Moab. Paparachafei, Vayeshiv Yisrael Bashitim, Vayachelam Liznos El Benos Moab. The people would commit averus, illicit sexual acts with the daughters of Moab. The motto of people who follow their taivas was formulated long ago by the generation of the Mabel. Vayiru b'nei ha'elohim es b'nos ha'adam ki tovos heina, vayikhu le'nashim mikol asher b'charu. That's what Soloveitchik develops the idea. What's the problem with taivas? Mikol asher b'charu. Taiva has no boundaries, no limits, no end. No structure. What the Torah underlines is the phrase Mikol asher b'charu. Orgiastic man seeks freedom from any normative system interfering with the human hedonistic tendencies. No authority, this worldly or transcendental, may legislate how man should enjoy his life as long as he does not infringe on the rights of others. She agrees, he agrees. What's the problem? We're all happy. Orgiastic man not only responds to inevitable biological urges, whose fulfillment yields pleasure, but experiments with precipitating new pleasures and unheard of, newly contrived artificial situations, which challenge the body to respond by engaging in gratifying action. Our Western society is a typical representative of the aesthetic society. The Torah hates orgiastic man, whose abominable way of life was censored by the 10th commandment, Loi Sachmod, you shall not desire, you shall not covet. Meaning, do not desire something which is beyond your reach. One must not stretch out his hand toward infinity, towards carnal boundlessness, toward the vastness that the flesh demands of man. The Torah did condone pleasant, happy, and gracious living if enjoyment is boundaried and the call of the blood is moderate. One may pursue pleasure if he knows how to retreat at the proper moment. Four times, orgiastic man appears in the Chumash, and Hashem, who was patient and kind, punished him severely. Number one, Chava eating from the Eitz Hadas. Number two, the Mabul, the generation of the flood. Three, Kivros HaTaiva. Even the smallest one collected 10 piles of the slav. Fourth, at Pa'or. Right over here. Oh, by Pa'or. Sorry. Vayochalam liznos el benos moav. Said Rav Salvechik, when I speak of orgiastic men or a hedonistic society, I'm not referring exclusively to sexual issues. As a matter of fact, the Western world is addicted to this. In many European countries, it's reached absurd proportions. However, I classify it any kind of boundlessness or without boundary. Whenever the fantasy begins to stimulate man and to stir up an unqualified yearning for the finite goods of sense, be it money, large homes, lust, food, social prominence, orgiastic man is aroused. The miser who piles up golden coins without spending a nickel on himself also belongs to this society. He can't satiate his hunger for gold. Whether orgiastic man is a great industrialist, a brilliant financier, a businessman, a Casanova, or a Napoleon, they are all members of the same society. Their imagination is surrounded with goods of sense and the halo of self-fulfillment. Their society is orgiastic, aesthetic, non-rational. And he goes on and on here. I'll just try to close it out here. Judaism defies the philosophy of the redemptive potential of the aesthetic experience. Judaism tenaciously and persistently maintains that the experience of beauty is not all redemptive. On the contrary, beauty exerts a hypnotic influence over man, divesting him of his freedom of thought and action. No experience can be considered cleansing and purging if it robs man of his dignity. Is beauty good and art cathartic by its very nature? I have heard that there was a Gestapo officer there who was in the Holocaust, who was an accomplished musician, an expert on Beethoven and Mozart. He was also an expert in killing children. He particularly liked to engage in both of his hobbies simultaneously. When he sat at a piano organ in the courtyard of the Gestapo headquarters in Vilna, the Gestapo officers used to line up little babies and children. Ambidextrous, he played Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata with his right hand, while with the left hand he was busy shooting innocent babies one by one. Is this the kind of catharsis of which Aristotle spoke? If you investigate the background of Hitler, Yimach Shimon, his entourage, which consisted of psychopaths and maniacs, you will find among them many people who developed a sense of beauty, accomplished musicians, art critics, and the like. They loved beauty and had succumbed to beauty. but they also liked spilling blood, particularly Jewish blood. Somehow beauty did not protect them from murder. So he's saying this running after pleasure, just because it's beautiful, doesn't mean that you're going to have the right kind of boundaries. And this is a problem that we always face, the question of running after physical pleasure and making sure that pleasure is boundaried in the right way. And even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have the answer here of salvation. At the very, very end, on page 203 here, says, Bilam understood a fundamental principle regarding the Jewish people and gave Balak advice how to defeat them. Elokeim shel elu sone zima. Bilam said, God hates Znus. This incident is the one and only instance in which Moshe becomes despondent. He who fearlessly defended the people after the Cheta Egel, and even after the spies, Hashem El Erech Apayim, and the Korach incidents, suddenly is found weeping at the entrance of the Ohel Moed. At Shittim, the brave and tenacious master of all the prophets lost his resolve. Bilam was about to win his battle against the Jewish people, and Moshe, his adversary, was on the verge of despair. Why? Because without the sanctity of family life, Knesset Yisrael can no longer exist. Until Bilam came and he saved the day. Anyway, we will stop here. I want to wish everyone a great Shabbos. Let's remember the vitality of life. Let's live life to the fullest. Let's celebrate life, even though chuk, death, is this great chuk. Let's celebrate life. And let's remember that everything, pleasure in Judaism, has boundaries. And we're supposed to look to try to sanctify and elevate and make sure that we have the proper boundaries. I apologize that I have to run to something else, but I wish everyone an awesome Gevaldik Shabbos. Thank you. Next Friday, it's very likely that there will not be Shabbos. I'm away. I'm going away on Tuesday. I'm away for the week. It's likely there won't be Shabbos, but I will try to record something onto the WhatsApp group before Shabbos, Bez Hashem, next week. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos, Rabbi.
Shabbos. Thank you. Shabbos.